Good afternoon. I think it's time for us to get started. My name is Jonathan Adler. I'm a professor and director of the Center for Business Law and Regulation at Case Western Reserve University. And our final panel of the day is looking at the road ahead for climate change regulation. We have a new administration. We have increased political and legal pressure for action of some sort on climate change. Legislation and or regulation may be inevitable, and certainly more litigation on climate change, I think, is inevitable as well, whether it's over the existing regulations, preemption, common law nuisance, and what have you. And what this panel, I think, is going to talk a little bit about is what we might see and perhaps what we should see or would want to see in the context of climate change. Joining me today on the panel is a distinguished group of folks to talk about this issue. Jason Johnston of the University of Pennsylvania, Sean Hecht of UCLA, and David Dana of Northwestern. I'm going to give some opening remarks since in my dual role as moderator and presenter. I will then turn it over to Sean, and then to Jason, and then to David, and then hopefully we will have some vigorous discussion and Q&A on this important issue. I think as a general matter, there may be a broad consensus about the existence of climate change, that is, that greenhouse gases have increased in the atmosphere, and that all else equal, that will produce a warming of some amount. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change says that somewhere between 3 and 7 degrees Fahrenheit by the year 2100 is something that we can expect. The Environmental Protection Agency has certainly said that climate change is a concern, but that's probably about as far as the consensus reaches. What we should do, how we should do it, something about which there is tremendous debate. And if one looks in the particulars of lots of different issues, what happens with hurricanes or what happens with sea level or what happens with polar bears, people argue about that until they're blue in the face. One thing that is, I think, beyond debate at this point, though, is that the policy process has already begun. And one of the things that I'm going to outline as an initial matter is that the regulatory train, in certain respects, has already left the station. And that may, and I think irrespective of one's view about the desirable set of climate change policies or non-policies, the particular regulatory train that's in motion is not one that is particularly desirable. And I'm going to explain why that is, or why I think that is, and give a sense of what the magnitude of the policy challenge is that confronts us. Massachusetts versus EPA is the case that reached the Supreme Court, in which the Supreme Court held that the litigants had standing to pursue climate change claims in federal court, but also, and perhaps more significantly for our purposes, held that the Clean Air Act covered greenhouse gases, that greenhouse gases are air pollutants subject to regulation by the EPA, and held that the EPA's denial of a petition to regulate greenhouse gases was arbitrary and capricious. Now, as a technical matter, the Supreme Court did not then say, EPA, you must now go forth and regulate greenhouse gases. That is, you will look in that opinion in vain if you were trying to find that sentence. What the court instead said was that if the EPA is going to refuse to regulate, it must conclude that it cannot make an endangerment finding, which is a shorthand of saying the administrator would have to conclude that he or she does not reasonably anticipate that the emission of greenhouse gases could reasonably be anticipated to adversely affect public health or welfare. The interesting thing about framing it that way, and I think the court was correct on this point, even though I've written elsewhere that I think it was wrong on its first two points, that is the standing and the statutory authority question, is that the EPA has said so much about climate change, so much about what it believes is occurring and what will occur. In fact, even just going up by what EPA said in the process of denying the petition to regulate greenhouse gases that prompted this litigation, that it would be very difficult for any administration to, at this point in time, say that it does not believe that the emissions of greenhouse gases can reasonably be anticipated to adversely affect human health and welfare. Given the level of scrutiny that courts give to statements by agencies, particularly if they are changing prior positions, even if the administration's EPA was inclined to try and not make such a finding, I don't think they could. And so as a consequence, as a practical matter, The EPA is required to regulate greenhouse gases under quite a few provisions of the Clean Air Act because they operate in tandem and in similar ways. And that has quite a few interesting implications. As an initial matter, the EPA is required to regulate emissions of greenhouse gases from new motor vehicles under Section 202 of the Clean Air Act. This is the provision that was actually at issue in the Massachusetts versus EPA litigation. But the definition of air pollutants aren't confined to these provisions. So, in fact, if greenhouse gases are air pollutants for purposes of Section 202, they're air pollutants for Sections 111, which is the new source performance standards for stationary sources. They're air pollutants for some of the other stationary source provisions, such as those that address what we call prevention of significant deterioration, which are the regulations for large emitters of air pollutants. And it probably also means that greenhouse gases are air pollutants subject to those provisions that create what we call national ambient air quality standards. That is the air quality standards that metropolitan areas and states are required to comply with in terms of ambient concentrations of air pollutants, that those provisions as well are triggered. And that while the EPA has not necessarily reached its conclusions itself, it does not take much ingenuity to write the legal briefs. In fact, I think the briefs write themselves that argue that EPA is compelled to do this. And this, I think most observers agree, in some respects creates a mess. That is to say, these provisions were not written to address a globally dispersed pollutant like carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas emissions. They are not designed to produce emission reductions in a particularly efficient way. But they will require the imposition of a lot of regulatory standards. To just look at the prevention of significant deterioration regs, an area that people haven't, I don't think, focused on a lot. These are provisions that were primarily aimed at ensuring control emissions from the really large polluting facilities, the big factories, the big power plants. They only apply to facilities that emit either over 100 tons or 250 tons per year of the pollutant in question. And for traditional pollutants, that only meant a relatively small number of facilities were covered. But given the nature of carbon dioxide and the rate at which carbon dioxide is approved, if we apply these same standards now to carbon dioxide, we will have at least a tenfold increase in the number of facilities or the number of buildings that are required to get these permits. And these are permits that can routinely take 12 to 18 months to process and obtain, and in many cases hundreds of thousands of dollars merely to obtain the permit, forgetting the actual compliance and the implementation of the technology or the emission control requirements that these permits put in place. Certainly this is something that the EPA and the various state agencies that implement the Clean Air Act have not planned for, do not have the resources or personnel for, at least under their current budget. And this is only one provision that I believe is effectively triggered by Massachusetts versus EPA. If we start talking about the creation of a national ambient air quality standard for carbon dioxide and the effort to impose an air quality standard that states are supposed to meet for individual metropolitan areas, even though carbon dioxide is a globally dispersed pollutant, the complexity and the unwieldy nature of the problem gets even worse. And I think there is fairly broad agreement that if one was starting from scratch to figure out how to create a regulatory system for greenhouse gases, one wouldn't come anywhere close to the system that is created by the Clean Air Act. There's a lot of difference about whether or not we want the extent to which we want trading or the extent to which we want technology standards, but the particular provisions that are in the Clean Air Act are not what I think anyone would come up with, and in fact, neither the Obama administration nor the McCain campaign argued for anything of this sort. What a lot of people argue for, and I think some of our panelists will say a little bit more about, is a cap-and-trade system. That was really what makes the most sense, is that you want to have some overall limit to the amount of emissions of greenhouse gases, and then have a system where you can trade so to ensure that those who are the most efficient or that can reduce emissions at the lowest cost do so. And there's been some discussion about, well, could the EPA just do that? You know, is the Clean Air Act a flexible and nimble enough statute to allow the EPA to do that? And there were some folks, I think, that came up with creative arguments about how that might be done. My own view is that any hopes of creating a cap-and-trade system under the existing act were dashed when the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit struck down something called the Clean Air Interstate Rule, which was an effort to create a multi-state emission trading regime for traditional air pollutants that are regionally dispersed. and it was covering many states. And while that rule remains in place, while it's been remanded to the agency, the language and reasoning of the D.C. Circuit, I think, makes it very difficult to conceive of how the EPA could, certainly in any short time frame, come up with a cap and trade regime under its existing authority. So what this means is that if this regulatory train is moving along, we would like something different, it's something that cannot be done purely administratively, and it has to be done through legislation. Now, there's another regulatory train that's left the station as well that I think also creates a mess, and a mess of the sort that wasn't intended by those that drafted the statute, and that involves the Endangered Species Act. As you probably all know, the Bush administration, in response to litigation, agreed to list polar bears as a threatened species under the Endangered Species Act due to the concern that their projected loss of Arctic sea ice habitat made their eventual endangerment foreseeable. And this is significant for a bunch of reasons. I mean, significant particularly for polar bears because it actually has some effects on polar bears that are actually negative for polar bear conservation. In particular, it cuts off some funding. It has the effect of cutting off some funding sources for polar bear conservation in Canada. But in particular, one of the effects this has is it triggers what's called Section 7 consultation under the Endangered Species Act. And I'm going to oversimplify this, but basically one of the things the Endangered Species Act requires is that federal agencies consult with the Federal Fish and Wildlife Service before they undertake, fund, or permit any activity that could imperil a listed species or destroy its habitat. And because federal agencies aren't supposed to do anything that would do that, and the Supreme Court has interpreted these provisions as quite strong, and these aren't provisions that allow agencies to say, well, you know, we think what we're doing is more important than these species in question. They really require the federal government to do no harm. And the way the Section 7 has historically been interpreted by the courts is that particularly at the point at which one decides whether to engage in consultation, a very broad net is cast. So even if one thinks that permitting an individual power plant or constructing an individual highway in and of itself does not pose any particular threat to polar bears because the marginal contribution to greenhouse gases is not that significant, and so the marginal threat to sea ice habitat is not that significant, consultation is still required before that determination can be made. And as Fish and Wildlife Service officials have readily acknowledged, they don't have the resources or the manpower to undertake existing consultation requirements. So, for example, consultation requirements for certain pesticide regulations with the EPA aren't done because the resources simply aren't there, and their consultation obligations would increase probably by several orders of magnitude as a consequence of this listing. The Bush administration, one of its midnight regulations was an effort to effectively try and rewrite Section 7 of the Endangered Species Act. As a general matter, trying to reduce the consultation requirements across the board, but the Bush administration was quite candid that one of the primary motivations for this was a recognition that if consultation is required for anything the federal government does, permits or funds, that could significantly increase greenhouse gas emissions, that it becomes a bureaucratic nightmare, not just because of the polar bear listing, but because there's something like 6 or 7 other Arctic species that will soon be listed as well under the Endangered Species Act. I'm going to offer 2 predictions, though. One is that there is litigation over the polar bear listing, and that litigation will fail. That is to say, even though there are reasons to wonder whether or not loss of Arctic sea ice would in fact drive polar bears to extinction, because polar bears somehow managed to survive the medieval warm period despite the lack of Arctic sea ice, the best available science is easily, and the way that's traditionally interpreted, easily supports the Fish and Wildlife Service's listing decision. The second prediction I'll make is that the Bush administration's effort to cabin Section 7 or limit it will fail, either because the new administration will rescind or revise the regulations or because the regulations will be struck down in court. And I think it's perhaps a strategic question in terms of how that proceeds, but I do not expect that regulatory revision to last. So we have another a regulatory train that can produce some particularly difficult results. And one of the reasons, this isn't just a complaint about, oh, well, there'll be too much regulation, there'll be too much red tape. If one looks just at the Endangered Species Act implications, if the Fish and Wildlife Service is required to engage in consultation for actions that affect greenhouse gas emissions, that is given current and projected staffing levels, given current and projected resource levels, it won't have the resources to do all the other things that we want it to do that actually do affect the conservation of various species of fish and wildlife. That is to say, if we believe the Fish and Wildlife Service is ever doing things that are valuable for wildlife conservation or for species conservation, there is no way it can do those things and meet the consultation obligations it will be required to comply with. And so I think that irrespective of one's view of regulation or the concerns about climate change, we have certain processes that are in motion that are undesirable. And I think that this will lead to a push for legislation of some sort. Now, let me say a tiny little bit about what the magnitude of doing something about climate change means before turning the podium over to Sean. During the campaign, Senator Obama, or President-elect Obama, endorsed what's often referred to as an 80 by 50 plan, which was only slightly more ambitious than the plan that was endorsed by Senator McCain. And basically, the idea is to reduce emissions of greenhouse gases in the United States by 80% by the year 2050. And I should just note, even if this is done, there is a question about whether or not we would stabilize atmospheric concentrations of greenhouse gases at the equivalent of 500 parts per million of carbon dioxide. To put that in perspective, currently we're at about, I think it's 385 parts per million pre-industrial levels of carbon dioxide. We're below 300 parts per million. So even something as dramatic, and I think in some respects jaw-dropping, as reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 80% by the year 2050, at best stabilizes atmospheric concentrations of greenhouse gases at almost double their pre-industrial levels. If we want to stabilize at levels below that, Jim Hansen, the NASA scientist, says that we should be aiming for below 350. We need something even more ambitious. Well, what does that mean? 2006, the United States emitted about 5.8 billion metric tons of carbon dioxide, about in the neighborhood of 20 tons per capita. So we're talking 80% reduction. Well, starting point, that's 4 tons per capita by the year 2050. That's about the amount of carbon dioxide equivalent that was emitted in the United States in 1910. But it's actually, we have to go farther than that because of population increases. If we assume that the population of the United States in 2050 is somewhere around 420 million, we have to keep going. And it comes up to about 2.5 tons per capita in terms of our emissions. And Steve Hayward at the American Enterprise Institute looked around the world and tried to find, well, what countries are emitting at that level? And it turns out the answer is countries like Belize and Mauritius and Jordan. By comparison, France and Switzerland, which I think are the best per capita performance in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, are around 6.5 tons per capita. And that's because France, in part because France relies so heavily on nuclear power and Switzerland so heavily on hydropower. So we're talking quite dramatic reductions, reductions that might be possible, but certainly at present technology are quite daunting. So my last point is that in thinking about this climate change policy, we not only have to think about what sort of policy we want going forward, what we want to replace these regulatory trains, which I think will create a massive regulatory train wreck if allowed to proceed, but I think we also need to think more broadly about what sorts of policies we want, not simply be thinking about emission reductions and emission controls, but also thinking about what really enhances and unleashes innovation, because existing projected technologies come nowhere close to the emission reductions that are foreseen. And we also, because so much of the projected warming is essentially hardwired into the system, whether we like it or not, we have to think very seriously about how do we deal with the consequences that is likely or at least possible or potentially to produce, not just for us, but particularly those parts of the world that are more vulnerable. And with that, I will turn things over to Sean.
So I think Jonathan has done a great job of setting out a basic overview of where we're at in terms of climate regulation. I wanted to start with just a few points to kind of bring this down to a more concrete level. Where does carbon dioxide come from? Well, it comes from the burning of fossil fuels, and most of that is gas-powered cars, coal-fired power plants, fossil fuel burning. And so When we think about, you know, is this going to take us back to the Stone Age? Is it going to be something that's going to require us to ramp down all of the energy use that we have? We have to be thinking in terms of what is it that we can substitute for these technologies, and how expensive would it be to do that? And how much would that be inevitable anyway? So, for example, in the case of oil, I think it's fair to say that over the time horizon we're talking about, oil is likely to be to become more expensive. It's a non-renewable resource, and we're likely to have to find substitutes for it anyway. In the case of something like coal, it's a little bit more complicated, at least in the United States. We have ample coal reserves, and it's not that clear that coal is going to become so expensive that we have to turn away from it in the absence of other incentives to do so. But I think it's important to keep in mind that that's essentially what we're talking about here. Another thing I think it's important to keep in mind as we think about climate change is we are more or less adapted to current conditions. We create infrastructure that's adapted to current conditions. Our building sector depends on a set of conditions that exist in the world, our ability to get water to places that need it, our ability to get everything that we rely on relies on a set of conditions that exist in the world. And so the question we need to ask is, to what extent is a changing climate going to change the conditions to which we are essentially adapted? And if so, what are the relative costs of, on the one hand, trying to prevent that from happening, and number two, trying to figure out how you adapt to changed conditions? And the more changed the conditions are, the harder it's going to be to create the ability to adapt to it. And so I think it's important to keep that aspect of it in mind as well. We're not just talking about preserving polar bears, as important as that may be. We're talking about things that are going to affect the real lives of people if what most scientists, the vast majority of scientists, believe is true. Even on the low end of the predictions, it's going to change the conditions to which the functioning of our society is adapted to a significant extent. So what do we do about that? Identifying the causes of carbon dioxide emissions and climate change leads us to the opportunities for reduction of those things. And when we talk about consumption of fossil fuels, we're talking about a large portion of the electricity that's generated in the United States, and we're also talking about the way that we power our vehicles in the United States. And between those two, we have an enormous percentage of all of the emissions that we have. And there are several things we can do. We can reduce the carbon dioxide that we emit. We could also potentially sequester carbon dioxide. We could have a plant that burns coal, and all the carbon dioxide that's produced from that burning could potentially be injected into some place where it's stored. And that's technology that is under development, and it's not clear to what extent that's going to be something that will be workable. If it is workable, it has to be regulated in some way because it has potential negative impacts that might be associated with it. The other thing to keep in mind is that we have the ability of natural systems to sequester carbon. Our climate is regulated in part by the oceans sucking up carbon and also by forests and other biomass storing carbon, which, if it weren't stored there, would be in the atmosphere. And so the other part of the question is, to what extent can that help to regulate the climate, and how much do we want to mess with that in a way that's human-induced? what can we do? What should we do about this? There are people who created cost curves on this, economists who looked at this and figured out, well, what is it going to cost to deal with this problem? And it turns out that some of the solutions have a negative marginal cost associated with them. These tend to be things that involve energy efficiency, insulation of buildings. There are things that more than pay for themselves. If a business were smart and looking to the future to long-term profitability, it would do this stuff anyway because it'll save it money. It'll save the business money. And so one of the things that can be done is to take advantage of those situations and to eliminate the market failures that prevent businesses and individuals from engaging in the behaviors that actually have a negative marginal cost to them that would help to deal with the things that cause climate change. Now, even once we do that, we don't get close to the level of reductions that we need to get to the level of carbon dioxide such that the climate isn't going to change significantly. And then we start looking at other things, changing of technology in various ways, more reliance on renewable power, stuff like that. But in the end, we need a diverse set of strategies, and that's complicated from a regulatory perspective because you need diverse strategies to try to figure out how to create those new conditions. So, you know, through the law, we can create structures and institutions that can either mitigate carbon dioxide emissions, reduce them, or to lessen the impacts, and we have to look at both sides of that. The law, until very recently, had not dealt with climate issues at all in any jurisdiction in the United States. This is brand new, and except in certain incidental ways. So, for example, fuel economy standards have been around for a while. They were not created specifically with an intention to slow climate change, but they have the impact of slowing climate change. Same with appliance efficiency standards, other things. All the things that were created to deal with energy conservation back in the 1970s turn out, because energy consumption is correlated with carbon dioxide production, if that energy comes from fossil fuels, all of those measures tend to affect the climate in a way that's positive. But there have been no laws until very recently actually specifically dealing with climate change. And part of the reason for that is that it's hard to know exactly what one does. And there's also a perception that this has to be dealt with at an international scale. Something Jonathan didn't talk much about, I don't know if our other panelists will talk about, is the reality that even if the United States reduces its emissions, there's still the rest of the world out there, and that there's an international dynamic that makes it very difficult for countries to have the incentive to be the first mover on this, or really to move at all in the absence of international agreements. And there's not that much incentive for developed countries and developing countries to sit at the table together and figure out how to accomplish that. For a long while, people depended on international agreements that have been ineffective up till now. But recently that started to change, and it changed in particular with the advent of some new legislation in California over the last few years. And you might wonder, well, why is it that local government or state government would have any role whatsoever in this type of thing? Interestingly, under the Clean Air Act, in particular, California has had a historically special role, and it's been given an opportunity to regulate in many cases ahead of the federal government in a way that's stricter than the federal government. And in many cases, this has had the effect of motivating other jurisdictions to do what California has done, and has had a ripple effect that's gone national and in some cases even international. It's also the case that there are certain things that are regulated traditionally at the state and local level that have a deep impact on climate change. And in particular, the building sector and the transportation sector are heavily regulated both by state and local governments. Land use planning is an inherently local thing throughout the country. Things like building codes, to a certain extent, appliance efficiency standards, and certainly regional transportation planning are things. These are all features that of our economy and of our ecology that specifically are regulated at the non-federal level to a great extent. And so we see California, for example, having the potential to have a major impact in these areas. And this started a few years ago with a law that's commonly called the Pavley Law, or AB 1493, which required carbon dioxide reductions from the tailpipes of cars in California. It's something that generally is correlated with energy efficiency, and there's a set of questions about what it is that whether it was permissible for California to do that. What's clear is that it's permissible for California to do that now only if the federal government grants a waiver of preemption, which it traditionally has in other contexts, but it has not. And Jonathan has written about the pros and cons legally of granting a waiver. I think it's fair to say that the Obama administration is likely to grant this waiver of preemption, and that will allow California to move forward with these regulations. There are already, I believe, 19 states that have adopted or declared their intention to adopt these same regulations that California has, and undoubtedly cars will be built, as ultimately they have been in with respect to other pollutants, cars will be built to these standards, which aren't so different from what car manufacturers would have done anyway for a number of different reasons, it turns out, although they have fought these regulations in court. The difference between their timetable and the regulatory timetable turns out to be very small. California has also On the building front, because of the California Environmental Quality Act, which requires environmental review of government actions and actions permitted by local and state government, environmentalists and the State Attorney General's office in California have successfully argued that the climate change impacts, in particular greenhouse gas emissions, have to be considered by government before they issue permits to projects, whether these projects are local building projects, development projects, things like that. It's mostly come up in the context of large regional plans, general plans, and transportation plans that create the blueprint for development in different areas of the state. But the consideration of greenhouse gases in this planning process has created a dramatic change in the building industry's approach to what we might call green building in California. And it turns out that developers have had a tremendous regulatory motivation to adopt those standards, which has interestingly coincided with a market motivation to do it. And so we see increasingly the builders deciding to build to green standards in California, which means in general more energy efficiency and less consumption of energy, which will have a significant effect towards reducing the greenhouse gas emissions here in California. Most recently, we have AB 32, which is really the main event. That is the law in California that ultimately is going to result in the creation of a cap and trade program that covers many sectors of the economy and causes a cap on greenhouse gas emissions from these various sectors. It's a very complex law that will have a complex set of regulations, and at this point we are in, I believe, the second or third year since the law was passed, and we have a scoping plan that's come out which describes what's likely to happen when the regulations come out, but we don't have regulations yet. It's a very interesting set of things that have happened as a result of this. I mean, one thing that's happened is, at least in California, every law firm that I'm aware of with an environmental practice now has a climate change practice. A lot of them didn't hire any more attorneys in order to do that, strangely enough, and didn't change their work in any really dramatic way. But it turns out that businesses are very, very focused on this, and attorneys see this as a growth area. Thanks. The reason for this is that it's going to affect a lot of sectors of the economy. We have the likelihood that this is going to that about 85% of the state's greenhouse gas emissions are going to be covered by the cap and trade program and a couple of other associated things. And this comes from capping greenhouse emissions, mostly from power plants and ultimately from the fuels that go into our vehicles. So at the same time, we have the potential for federal efforts here. And last year there were a number of federal bills that would have done essentially the same thing at the federal level. And of course, when you think about it, it conceptually makes a lot more sense to have a cap and trade program with a broader geographical section of the economy. It doesn't make any sense in a broad sense to have only California or California and a few other states doing this for a few reasons, one of which is the potential for what's called leakage in the trade, meaning essentially a race to the bottom by industry that might go elsewhere in order to produce their greenhouse gas emissions because they can't do it in this jurisdiction. And there are other concerns as well. It just doesn't make a lot of sense conceptually to have that limited a geographical scope. But on a national level, we are likely to see, I think, a cap and trade scheme enacted at some point in the next couple of years. I don't know that it's going to happen this year. I'm not sure how, with all that's going on in the world, I don't know how politically feasible it's going to be for the new administration to do it. But talking to a lot of folks who are lawyers in the area and who are part of regulated industries, I think people are ready for this to happen and are fully expecting that there will be a cap and trade scheme. And in fact, there are a lot of business people who are who are not necessarily unhappy about that. They feel like they can position themselves to benefit for it, benefit from the markets that is going to create in one way or another. So on the federal level, I think we're likely to see that. What seems to be missing from this whole conversation, what I want to close with, is a little bit of a discussion about adaptation. As Jonathan said, there's no question that there will be increases, and there have been increases in carbon dioxide concentrations. There will continue to be increases, and that the best case scenarios that we can imagine involve stabilization of carbon dioxide levels at a point where there will be significant changes in our climate and in our weather patterns. And so the question is, what do we do about that? How do we create communities and infrastructure that are resilient to these changes? whatever in whatever way that, or shape the changes take. And it's hard to say, in part because there's a lot of uncertainty about exactly what the impacts will be. We don't know how much sea level will rise. We don't know how much the snowpack will be reduced in the Sierra. We don't know what the conditions are that will enable us to adapt. But I think also because it's going to be delayed, we risk not paying enough attention to the adaptation side of this. And I'll also say that there's some fear, I think, among people who take the climate threat seriously, that focusing too much on adaptation will make people feel like they have a reduced incentive to reduce climate emissions, because they'll feel like, oh, we can just adapt to this. What people who've studied it, I think, in more nuance have concluded is that you need to do both at once. You need to reduce because you don't have to adapt as much if you don't have as much to adapt to. And so the idea is to try to figure out, well, what are the steps we can reasonably take to create resilient communities? It's very difficult to do, though. Major insurance and reinsurance companies have been spending a lot of time and effort trying to figure out what you do about this. And they have concluded essentially that the incentives that people have and that businesses have are mostly all wrong, and that we have to be creating incentives that will ensure that people are not able to continue to live in communities that will be inundated by sea level rise under climate change. We have to create ways of ensuring that we're going to be resilient to the various weather patterns that we're going to have, and we have to create security for our food supply in case of drought and other situations like that. So to conclude, I think thinking of climate as an environmental problem in the sense that environmental law is considered a sort of cabined off field is not going to be enough. This regulation, whether we like it or not, is going to pervade various aspects of our economy. Some people are very resistant to that. Other people welcome it. I think it's just a fact of life. We're going to have to change various ways that we go about doing business and governing in order to deal with climate change. And I think I'll be interested to see what happens over the next few years. Thanks a lot.
How come you didn't get applause? Huh? How come you didn't get applause?
What can I say? This is crazy. We're in the middle of the greatest economic depression since the Great Depression. This may turn out to be the greatest and most severe worldwide economic depression in over 100 years. Sean was talking about, and as Jonathan pointed out, the same thing, that if we really tackle the global warming problem in the way and with the ardor that some environmental advocates wish that we would, then we'll have a regulatory system that pervades various aspects of our economy. It means we're going to fundamentally have to change our economy and our political system. When I say this is crazy, the reason I say this is crazy is because neither the economics of climate change nor, and even more importantly, the science of climate change provides any reason to think that such a vast, unbelievably costly undertaking should be done. No one who reads the economic literature in this area, no one who can read and actually understand the scientific literature in this area, could ever, in my opinion, come away thinking that what we should do right now is take immediate, unbelievably costly action to decarbonize the American economy. That is what this is all about. That is what this has been about since the late 1970s, early 1980s, when this became a major issue on the agenda of the United Nations Environmental Program and some other international organizations. For environmentalists, some environmentalists at least, this has always been about decarbonization of economies in the developed world that are based on burning different kinds of fossil fuels for energy. I'm writing a book, and some people have asked me, why would you write such a book? Why would you be writing these articles? Why would you write this book? And the book talks about climate change policy and the science and economics of climate change, and I'm going to outline parts of the book here in the few minutes that I have. The bottom line, I'll tell you right now, I think, is that we have been inadvertently running an unintentional experiment, that is to say, not just the United States, but the rest of the developed world, putting a lot of carbon dioxide up into the atmosphere. Is there some possibility that if the level of carbon dioxide reaches certain levels, then at some point after, say, 2100, which is in the climate change world known as the short to medium term, that is to say out to 2100, is there some possibility there'll be severe, very harmful impacts? Yeah, there's some possibility. Can it be quantified? No. Can you attach probabilities to it? No. Can you attach magnitudes to the potential harm? No. But that possibility may justify, it seems to me, and this is not where I usually come out on these things, a greater government involvement in encouraging research into alternative technologies, including carbon capture and sequestration. So let me highlight parts of these papers. The first paper came out in the Notre Dame Law Review a few months ago, and it's entitled Climate Change Confusion in the Supreme Court on the Misguided Regulation of Greenhouse Gases under the Clean Air Act. It's misguided for some of the reasons that Jonathan already went over, but I also think it's very misguided because when you look at the economics and climate change, and look at what economists who've spent a long time thinking about this say, the first thing that strikes you is that the costs and benefits of taking steps to reduce greenhouse gas emissions varies enormously across different regions of the United States. As many of you may know, the regions, we have different regions in terms of electricity grid, and different regions are dependent on different fuel sources. You go out west, Oregon, California, Arizona, get a lot of hydro, where they're all on the same grid, Washington, particularly Washington, Oregon, California, you get a lot of hydro, and very little dependence on coal. Basically, hardly any coal is burned, which means there's not much carbon dioxide, which means the cost of decarbonizing the energy supplies in these states is relatively low. You move into the Midwest or the South, where coal is a much more important source of power, and the cost of climate change of controls on the emissions of carbon dioxide in particular would be very, very high. So the argument, I want to get back into this article, you all can take a look at it, but the point of this article is just to say, gosh, is there any way to think, I think what people did when they voted for the Clean Air Act is they thought, well, some of my constituents are going to bear costs, but the passage of the Clean Air Act will generate benefits in terms of a healthier local environment for most or maybe all of my constituents, depending upon the part of the country you're talking about. That's not true of climate change. There are many parts of the country where climate change would bring benefits. You look at the upper Midwest, and it's very, very clear. It would stimulate agricultural productivity. It would cut heating costs. I mean, you look at places like North Dakota and states like that. So when you're saying that a senator or a congressperson who voted for the Clean Air Act would have also voted for the Clean Air Act to extend to the regulation of greenhouse gases, you're saying somebody who voted for something that was going to benefit all of his or her constituents and cost some of them would have also voted for something that was going to cost all of his or her constituents and generate no foreseeable benefits in the immediate to near to medium-term future. So, and that's just, and in the paper I talk, there's all kinds of evidence about this. So if you look at the evidence on the economics, it's very difficult to see how you could interpret the Clean Air Act the way the Supreme Court interpreted it, if you think what you're doing when you're interpreting statutory language is engaging in purposive interpretation. But that's a foregone conclusion, and as both speakers pointed out, it does seem like there's this sort of regulatory train that's moving ahead. But what's most amazing about this from my point of view, and this is the second article in the series that I'm now actually having some climate scientists look at, is the science is shockingly uncertain. Sean was speaking as if certain things are known to occur. They're not known to occur. These models, general circulation models, are not models of the world. Just because they're mathematical doesn't mean they represent the world. I build mathematical models. What they do is they're a way of expressing a particular climate scientist's view or a particular collection of climate scientists organized into different research units across the world, their view of how things interact. Let me point out two very, very, I could go on and on about the science, that's why I'm writing the second article. But let me point out two fast, important things that everybody has to understand about climate science. the big temperature increases that are sometimes predicted or to which are attached positive probability that this might occur, okay, where do those come from? Do those come from the carbon dioxide increase alone? No. A doubling of carbon dioxide alone, and any climate scientist will tell you this, if that was the only thing going on, maybe an increase in average global surface temperature of about a degree Fahrenheit or more, no more than a degree centigrade. The big increases in temperature come entirely from feedback effects. What's a feedback effect? The snow melts, right? So you have less reflection. The albedo decreases, and therefore you've got more surface warming. Or the most important feedback effect is very basic, sort of one of the real basic little laws in physics is that warmer air holds more moisture. The most powerful greenhouse gas, 17 times more powerful than carbon dioxide, is water vapor. So what do the models predict? The models predict that as the atmosphere warms, it'll hold more water, which is an increase in water vapor. That's another positive feedback. Here's the key thing, guys. In these models, positive feedbacks predominate. In particular, clouds, the response of clouds in a warming temperature is assumed to be a positive feedback. There is mounting evidence that that's probably not true. High-level clouds tend to, speaking loosely, reflect back solar radiation. Low-level clouds tend to do what? Low-level clouds tend to reflect back solar radiation. Anybody knows that on a cloudy day, what's happened? You're kind of in the shade, and it's cooler. So the net effect on clouds depends upon the impact. The feedback from clouds depends upon the net balance between the impact on high-level clouds and low-level clouds. There's evidence that actually the impact on low-level clouds is going to be stronger on high-level clouds, so it's going to be a negative feedback, and yet all these models assume a positive feedback. It is absolutely remarkable. The extent to which I believe in the IPCC and climate change scientist advocates have glossed over and dismissed fundamental questions. I can't answer these questions. I'm not a climate change scientist, but I've written this article, the second article in this series, just to say, will someone ask these questions before we go ahead trying to decarbonize our economy, to radically change the entire economy of the developed world? Can these questions at least be asked? And they have to be asked in a very precise way regarding what are the strengths and weaknesses of the models, what assumptions are the models making, and are those assumptions justified or not? So you may say, well, it's too late. They've won. Climate change scientist advocates have won. They persuaded everybody that this is just going to happen. I mean, the way Sean was talking is the way a lot of people talk. This is a foregone conclusion. Increased levels of carbon dioxide are causing global warming, and then the only question is, what are the consequences of global warming? What are those consequences going to be? How horrible will they be? What should we do? Can we do anything? As Sean was saying, it's true given the atmospheric half-life of carbon dioxide. You know, there's going to be some warming if these models are correct. So we better start adapting now, and also perhaps cutting our levels of carbon dioxide. It's just remarkable the extent to which the science has become an accepted matter of fact. Well, let's grant that. Say, well, it is. The regulatory train has left the station. What do I think is going to happen? The bottom line is not very much, frankly. The economic preconditions for a successful cap and trade program, which are epitomized by the Title IV acid rain program, are what? Cap and trade programs work like this. You get so many permits to emit whatever it is we're talking about, in this particular instance, carbon dioxide. If you exceed your permitted level, then that is detected and you pay a fine. Title IV, the sulfur dioxide program under Title IV works. Why? Because there's what's called continuous emissions monitoring, which is you cannot cheat and not get caught. And the penalty that you have to pay is like $2,000 per ton. It's far, far above what the price has been to purchase permits to emit sulfur dioxide on the market, even at its highest level. There's never been any incentive and any reason to not do what you're supposed to do under Title IV, because if you fail to comply, you get caught with a probability of one, and you have to pay a super, super high fine. That is not true of greenhouse gas emissions and carbon dioxide emissions. I mean, basically, the simplest way the carbon dioxide emissions are are determined is just using kind of input-output ratios. If you know the fuel source that somebody's using, then you can kind of figure, you know, just through a direct input-output ratio, figure out what their carbon dioxide emissions are. That's true in some levels, and, of course, it's true for what? The power industry, they're the guys who are the easiest targets here. But it's not true for a lot of other sources of carbon dioxide. There's no way to know whether people are complying or not. And if this actually, if a cap and trade program were actually, if our government were to actually attempt to implement a cap and trade program, the cost would be so great I don't believe it would be credible. That is to say, Congress would go back on it. It would change the cap and trade program, just by the way, as Congress sort of retrenched from the original 1970 Clean Air Act in the face of the energy crisis of the 1970s. And what would we have gotten? What would we have ended up with this cap and trade program? Well, we would have ended up with the greatest excuse for an increase in the environmental bureaucracy in the United States in probably 30 years. If you look at Lieberman-Warner, the bill that, it had a decent chance last summer. Lieberman-Warner was a sprawling bill that would have affected virtually every sector of the American economy. Agriculture got offsets. People of little means who would be very, there's no doubt in any economic study that's been done that poor people who pay a lot, relatively speaking, use a lot of their budget, relatively speaking, to heat their homes and cool their homes in the summer, that this would amount to an enormously regressive tax on the poor. So Lieberman-Warner tried to fix that. The bottom line here is the one thing that was clear about Lieberman-Warner is it would have required a massive increase in the size of the environmental regulatory bureaucracy, beyond, I believe, anything we've ever seen before. With what impact? What actual impact on the environment? Who knows? So those are some predictions, loose, vague, but that's all you can do with climate change. There's no precision here. And the most dangerous thing in climate change, and the reason I think that we've gotten ourselves in this really unbelievable situation, is because of the power of numbers. People hear numbers, and they don't know where the numbers come from, but they're big numbers. And Al Gore, of course, is the master of this. Make a film, include 11 or 12 things in the film that are known to be false by the scientific community. Who cares? It's serving a good goal. Means justifies the ends. I mean, the ends justifies the means. There's a lot, that's the larger lesson here, but that's the later part of the book.
That's a hard act to follow. I guess the panel's entitled The Road Ahead, and you could take that just predictively, what is regulation going to look like, and of course none of us really know. And then you could take it normatively, what should it look like, and we could have quite different views. I guess the one thing I'd say is, and this is, I guess, consistent with what everyone said, is, climate change, both in the science and in the economics and the policy, is a domain of widely different predictions. And one of the basic questions here is how to deal with that kind of radical uncertainty and the potential for kind of maybe not the highest probability adverse consequences, but at least the possibility of catastrophic consequences. And so it is a domain of huge uncertainty. Just one other point, just kind of responding to Jason before I just make a couple of much more specific comments. I do think that the cap and trade that I'll get to in a few minutes is likely to be at least nominally what the United States tries to implement, kind of following more or less what the EU is doing as well. And it is true that it's hard to imagine that covering all industries. It's hard to imagine exactly how it's going to work. The EU experiment has been, some people think, not at all successful so far. But there really are two major sources of CO2 emissions, at least in my understanding, in the United States, motor vehicles and power plants. And I think the estimates are that those together constitute 65 or 70% of a current CO2 emission. So if you can get at that, it's true, getting the remainder, which almost no one is really trying to do, is very, very hard to regulate. But there is already intensive regulation and monitoring at most power plants. There are ways to kind of embed regulation through cars and the motor vehicle industry. So in some ways, I think, realistically, most of the regulation is focusing on those two sectors, somewhat unfairly picking on them because it does leave out a lot of other sectors. Okay. So what I wanted to talk about was kind of more grounded, which is just how this regulatory train that is out of the station. Whatever, you know what I mean. I don't know. I'm bad with complex metaphors. But anyway, what kind of issues might it raise? And I guess here's my basic take, is in some ways there's this yearning desire, at least for people who do believe climate change needs a regulatory response, for comprehensive rationality in the response. And the dream of comprehensive rationality is sort of Kyoto. It's like every country has a cap and trade system. They all coordinate. It's all international. We have this nice these units. We trade them all. It's sort of elegant, and we kind of comprehensively deal with the problem. And part of the appeal of that, apart from just kind of, you know, French bureaucrats or something, or kind of a certain kind of approach, is it seems almost logical if you think of the problem as CO2 units in metric tons, because after all, if it's a single currency that's the problem, why not have a comprehensive rationality dealing with it? And I think that that's not ever going to happen, or it's hard to imagine comprehensive rationality happen. I think whatever regulatory regimes develop are going to kind of build messily with overlaps and sort of tensions, both domestically, within Europe, within the world, and simply because for economic, political, and maybe just simply cognitive reasons, we can't really construct a politically palatable, implementable, single comprehensive rationality. So tied in with that, I think there are going to be a lot of tensions that come as the regulatory train moves in the United States. One of them, Sean talked about somewhat, which is the tensions between different levels of government. And I don't think those are going to disappear at all. In fact, I think they may become exacerbated if, in fact, Congress acts and the EPA acts with more regulation and legislation. The states really have been doing a fair bit in the area of carbon regulation, and not just California. There's a trading mechanism in the northeastern states. There's these car emission standards that Sean talked about have been adopted by East Coast and some central Midwestern states and the West Coast. And part of the rationale, and all of those efforts have raised questions about preemption under the Clean Air Act, preemption under other statutes, and more generally how they fit in with the federal model. And the basic rationale of a lot of the governors and even the NGOs has been, well, the federal government wasn't doing anything, at least it wasn't doing anything focused on climate change that these people like, so the states had to do something. And in fact, that was kind of an explicit argument in a lot of litigation over cars, including in some kind of a little more far-fetched public nuisance litigation. Now, even if now Congress does enact something like the Lieberman bill or some variant, EPA does in fact start to include CO2 considerations and regulations, there's still going to be a diversity of opinion within the country as to what's adequate. There's still going to be kind of a different political calculus. Some of that does track, I think, different costs across the country. I think some of it tracks different ideology and different interest groups. And so I think you're going to see ongoing federal-state tensions where there really is a question is, will the states push? They can also pull back by refusing to implement, which is also another dynamic. And will they push? And will there be those kinds of conflicts? And that means one of the really central questions I think that's going to keep getting fought out is this question of federal preemption. Whatever the federal government does through agency action or through legislation, will it include clear language of express preemption? Don't count on it, right? Because there's too much disagreement to really have clear, crystalline language about exactly what's preempted at the state level. So what you're more likely to see is a variety of confusion as to exactly what the preemption standards are. Maybe there's some language saying it's preempted, some language saying it isn't. And what this means is a significant role is going to be played by the courts in determining those lines between federal and state and local authority, and in some sense the level of regulatory intensity. So I think this is an area or domain where through the realm of preemption, there's going to be a much more notable judicial role. That may not be a particularly good thing from a democratic legitimacy grounds. It may not be a particularly good thing since it's not clear courts have handled preemption doctrine particularly well. I mean, really kind of relying on formalism rather than actually supporting their conclusions. But I think that's going to be an important dynamic going forward. I think there's also going to be tensions potentially between the branches of the federal government that are going to be exacerbated by the regulatory train. On the one hand, you may see regulations coming out of EPA before there's new federal legislation, or kind of concurrently, new regulations coming under the Clean Air Act or other statutes at the same time as you see other new regulation. How all that fits together, what the White House or the executive thinks as opposed to what Congress and the agent Congress wants, may create tensions. And I think there's also this question of how the whole regulatory apparatus of the cost-benefit state and OMB review really gets worked out as you start to put a carbon dioxide more into these regulations. When you start talking about what are the costs of different regulations, what kinds of things are going to be approved through OMB, what kind of, if in fact there is some kind of cost-benefit analysis, you raise all these very difficult questions about assessing the economic costs of climate change, assessing non-use values, assessing transboundary values, and all of that's going to get pressed. And I guess Cass Sunstein's going to decide it all, right? Okay, so I don't know if that's good either. Okay, and then kind of a third really huge issue really is this question, again, which Sean mentioned some, about the international, the kind of federal versus non-federal, federal versus world dimensions. Pretty much everyone thinks Kyoto is a bust, I think. I mean, you know, in a sense that really it hasn't necessarily, I think that's an overstatement, actually. Some people think it's had some institutional benefits, but that it hasn't really produced much anywhere where you wouldn't have seen regulation already coming into place, that EU would have already been doing whatever it's doing, however you evaluate that. On the other hand, it's pretty clear that this problem calls for some kinds of international integration. And one question, and in fact a lot of the trading regimes inherently call for sort of using or acquiring credits across boundaries. And one question is, how are we going to see that develop? And my guess is you're not going to, because the Kyoto model doesn't seem to be working, I think you're going to see kind of more slow bilateral or kind of smaller multilateral agreements and understandings developing. I think the EU and the U.S., if the U.S. really does proceed, will have something like an integrated market on some level. I think you're going to see different kinds of regimes, almost like you do and have done in trade in various ways, where they're kind of bilateral and multilateral agreements. And again, I think that's more plausible, even if it's not as satisfying as kind of this regime of comprehensive rationality. So I think those are all things you're going to see. How am I doing on time?
You're doing well. You have 6 minutes.
I can talk slower. Okay. Just two other points, one about cap and trade and one about carbon taxes, which I don't think anyone's talked about. Exactly what's going to be the result of this, assuming Congress goes forward with a cap and trade measure, or assuming cap and trade kind of does sneak in under different kinds of Clean Air Act regulations? A huge amount of the issues really go to the design of the cap and trade mechanisms. I mean, the idea of cap and trade is there's a trade among different producers, and the theoretical idea is that the lowest cost producers reduce more, right, because the credits can be then sold. There's at least a theoretical argument that there might be an incentive for innovation. But everything is in the details, right? And as Jason's pointed out, there's a huge amount of political swarming around who gets allocated credits. And here we really see a huge gap between what most of the economists who are sympathetic, I think, to cap and trade would like and what the political process is likely to produce. A lot of the economic-oriented policymakers have favored some kinds of auction mechanisms, right, some kinds of mechanisms that try to take you away from the kind of rent-seeking and political kind of fighting for credits and potentially excess credits. But the political reality is to actually get something implemented, the most easiest way to do it is to give a lot of credits to the industry actors already in power, because they get them free, effectively, and because they're the ones already in place. And that tension, I think, is really going to be an important tension as the cap and trade develop over time. The kind of final issue I talk about, is carbon taxes versus cap and trade. I think, as Jason also said, in some ways, cap and trade effectively is a carbon tax, right, because it raises the cost of production on a lot of goods and services, and that translates into higher consumer costs at the end of the day. In a sense, you can think of it as a tax. But it's often, in the literature, counterpoised against a tax. You could have a system where just for every unit of carbon produced or every amount of carbon content, there was a certain kind of tax, like an excise tax, 5 cents, 10 cents by the metric ton, as opposed to this kind of trading mechanism. And there are pretty sophisticated analyses suggesting you can get to similar results using a tax regime as a cap and trade regime. And a lot of the argument really goes to questions of transparency. One of the things about cap and trade is it's very untransparent. It's hard to know what's going on. It's a mess, right? All these trades are happening. No one really knows. You have this cap. It's getting ratcheted down. And really, if you look kind of cynically at the literature, some people think the lack of transparency is a good thing in cap and trade because otherwise we couldn't get it passed, going to the point of how you get this through. And some people think it's terrible because you couldn't get it passed if people knew it was going through. That essentially taxes are just a little too overt. They're a little too dramatic. So there is this tension, I think, between a kind of what might be the more democratically legitimate mechanism, the more honest mechanism, which is a carbon tax, and what's more politically really feasible and politically attractive to kind of all the actors in play, which is cap and trade. I guess the final thing I'd say about the taxes versus cap and trade is that may have important implications for kind of international issues. One of the big issues, kind of going back to foreign production of, or foreign emissions of carbon dioxide, is that any kind of American or even American EU-Japanese regulation ultimately can't make a huge dent in the inventory of carbon dioxide because China is China now the biggest emitter?
Yep.
China is now the biggest emitter. India, Brazil, other countries are certainly coming to board. So everybody accepts the idea that you can't really do much, although technological innovation would help, however it's generated, without bringing those countries on board. So in this analysis of what kind of regulation you want, one big issue is what kind of domestic U.S. or EU regulation will sort of bring on board, if it's possible, China and other countries. And there is an argument that cap and trade is better that way because at least there have been experiments in essentially having companies buy up their credits from Chinese companies who do energy efficiency projects. The real problem with that is an institutional one, which is a lot of those projects turn out to be fake or turn out not to really would have happened anyway. So there's real issues there, again, about transparency. But on the tax side, if you did a kind of tax system where you tax domestically industries, domestic production, it would put a lot of pressure on some kind of for some kind of countervailing tax on goods produced abroad. And it's harder in some ways to see how those negotiations go. I mean, it's harder to see how you have kind of a world tax. Ralph Nader, in an editorial in, of all places, the Wall Street Journal, a few weeks ago, I think, argued that a global carbon tax would work better than cap and trade. And there are some theoretical arguments where that might make sense. But if you think about that institutionally, politically, I just don't think that's really going to happen. So my basic view is I think this is going to be a huge mess. And I do. I mean, not the ESA and consulting, that's the least of it, right? But it's fun. But it's going to be a huge mess, and there's going to be so many different parts of the ways it's a mess. But on the other hand, given the centrality and the kind of ubiquitousness of the phenomenon that's being trying to regulate, I think it would be crazy to think it wouldn't be a mess, and that it wouldn't have to kind of percolate up and sort of be an evolutionary process. So, stop.
At this point, I didn't know if any of the panelists wanted to respond or comment on. I don't know if Sean, you wanted to respond to Jason, or we just want to go straight to questions. Or
I'm not here to debate climate science, and you know, I mean, if Jason wants to, you know, to question the assumptions of climate scientists, that's his prerogative to do that. I really came, to discuss the regulatory regime as it is. I'm convinced that the problem exists, as I understand, you know, the other panelists to be other than Jason. I certainly believe that there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty, and one of the fundamental questions here is what you do in the face of that kind of uncertainty. You know, is it more prudent not to regulate at this scale in the face of this scale of uncertainty, or is it more prudent to regulate? I don't think there's an easy answer to that question. I mean, I don't think it's obvious that one takes one or the other approach. What I will say is that economists who have done cost-benefit analysis on this seem to have concluded, well, I have concluded in looking at economists' cost-benefit analysis on this, that the cost-benefit calculus is driven at some level by the discount rate. And so, there may be people who disagree with that, who believe that the likely outcomes are so insignificant that that's not the case over a long time horizon. But from what I've seen, if you believe that you should discount future costs and future benefits on the scale of a generation or two or three or ten at a significant rate, it's very easy to make the case that you shouldn't do very much about climate change. If, on the other hand, you believe that intergenerational discounting at some level is not a legitimate way, not a legitimate methodology to use when you do cost-benefit analysis, because, in fact, although I would rather have a benefit today than 10 years from now, I might rather have my children or my children's children have those benefits. And if you believe that, then there's ample reason to think that there's a lot that we have to do about climate change. And, you know, again, I think that's a value judgment type question more than anything else about whether you use, you know, a 0.5% discount rate, as some people have, like the Stern report in, you know, out of England, or if you use a 5 or 6 or 7% discount rate on future costs and benefits, in which case it's pretty clear to see that if, you know, if we don't think that the worst costs are going to come till 2100, there's not much reason to do anything about them now. So
can I respond real quick?
Sure.
Yeah, actually, Sean's right about the importance of the discount rate, and there's two things that are notable about the Stern report. It gets its results because of basically using a zero discount rate for far future benefits. By the way, there are several places I could refer you to find the most scathing criticism of the Stern report as economics by other economists that I have ever seen. It is not viewed as economics, and Stern's response was, well, this isn't economics, it's ethics. The question is, how much do we care about the ninth generation in the future? And that's not an economic question, it's an ethical question. But here's the other thing, and I do think you're right, I totally agree with Sean, too. This is really, and some of the, actually all of us maybe agree on this, it's fundamentally about policy making under conditions of extreme uncertainty regarding the science and the economics. And that's a hard problem. Economists do not have an analytical, that is to say, a mathematical, neat solution to that problem yet. But I will say this. In the climate change area, what you start worrying about is these distant and potentially very, very large harms due to what Marty Weitzman, the Harvard environmental economist, calls the, you know, the 8 degree centigrade temperature increases that, you know, some of the models say are possible. Very, very important paper that isn't hardly ever talked about came out in the summer of 2007 by a climate scientist at University of Washington. Those 6, 7, 8 degree potential increases in temperature, degrees centigrade, are entirely due to the predominance of positive feedbacks in these models, and they show, it's elegantly shown, that because of the predominance of those positive feedbacks, even if we reduce the amount of uncertainty and learn a lot more about a lot of these feedbacks, these models will still attach positive probability to these huge temperature increases, these huge, really catastrophic temperature increases, 6, 7, 8 degrees centigrade around 2100 and in the farther future. That is to say, the models are driving this. There's no amount of learning, given the way the models are structured, that is ever going to lead to a situation where climate scientists, at least the modelers, could say, well, you don't have to worry about a 6, 7, 8 degrees centigrade catastrophic impact. The models are set up so there will always be positive probability of those catastrophic scenarios. It's just a mathematical artifact. It's an artifact of the models. So, I mean, I don't know. I don't want to debate science. I'm not a climate scientist, but there are aspects of climate science, it seems to me, that just are there. They're in the peer-edited literature, but no one hears about them. The media doesn't ask these questions. The media doesn't pick up on these articles. And a huge part of this whole climate science story, of course, is science and the media. Science, the media, and policy. And that's a very that's a very fundamental what a climate scientist would call teleconnection that's driven this whole thing, is the media's tendency to get this story and run with certain aspects of it and to create really what's kind of a hysteria.
Well,
if you have a comment, otherwise we can go to questions.
Yeah, we can go to questions.
Or I can throw my one comment. I'll just really quickly make on the issue of uncertainty is that two things. One is that the more tangible we want to, one thing I think everyone agrees with is the more tangible the effect we want to identify, the greater the magnitude of uncertainty. So let's take one example. I did a paper on this recently, water supplies. In parts of the United States, for example, where water supplies are scarce and poorly managed, Western United States, we know we don't have much uncertainty that if we see a several degree warming over the next, say, 100 years, that will have a significant effect on water supplies, on for example, the timing and distribution of water flows. It'll affect when we have precipitation. It'll affect when we have snow melt. It'll affect the volume and temperature of water flowing in various streams at various times of year. I mean, dramatic effects. That we know.
But you actually then, for example, read the IPCC and read the scientific literature on what those effects will be. You know, does it mean that water levels we had in May will now have in April in a particular state? Well, we have no idea. And that makes the policy challenge, I think, more difficult. It also, I think, should influence, and I think generally has not influenced, the way we evaluate the choice between making investments in mitigation, that is reducing emissions, versus making investments in adaptation, dealing with uncertainty. And the paper I recently did on water, one of the things that I argue about is that if climate change increases the uncertainty related to water supplies, then that increases the need for water institutions or managed institutions that can deal with uncertainty. And most of our water institutions that deal with the allocation of water deal with uncertainty terribly. I mean, they're basically massive subsidy infrastructure institutions as opposed to market-based institutions. But that's something that generally, I think, in the policy debate or policy discussion has generally been left out for a whole variety of reasons. But that was one comment.
Can I respond to that real quickly? I'm going to use several of these papers of Jonathan's in a chapter in the book called The Unintended Consequences of Climate Change Alarmism. I spend as much time as I can without getting fired at my home in Colorado. And in Colorado, there are now about 24 proposals for big new water projects, that is to say dams. There hasn't been a new dam built in Colorado since the 1960s. Since environmentalists came around and said, we're not building any more dams. Virtually every one of those new dams in the proposal and the petition for a permit, application for a permit, among the justifications for these projects are the expected consequences, in particular drought, of global warming. So, you know, global warming can go a lot of different ways in terms of providing a justification for lots and lots of different things. And in this case, it doesn't seem to me that it's consistent with what environmentalists have really, at least me as an environmentalist, would like to see happen.
Go to questions.
Yeah, just a question about.
You could also, I think this is being recorded for podcast and video, so just use the mic and you should use the mic and identify yourself. We know you're Mike Rappaport, but you should tell everybody.
Sometimes you hear that, you know, the thing to really worry about in the long run is global cooling, right? We have another ice age, a little ice age, and the like. And then, you know, you get these sort of, you know, what would really be bad is if we engaged in very expensive attempts at reducing global warming, and then just as we succeeded, we got the ice age, and then the global warming would help. That. So that sounds like a sad story. So I guess my question is, do we have good reason to believe that we're not going to have global cooling in the sense that we understand the ice ages and you know, we have good reason to think we got another 10,000 years? Or we just don't know. And we're just sort of assuming that things are going to continue going along the same way, and we just don't have knowledge about it. Because it seems to me that so do we simply not have knowledge, or we have knowledge it's not going to happen or not likely to happen?
I think it's even more confusing than that, because, I mean, Jason, you know more about this, but a lot of the models suggest you have global warming with areas of intense cooling. I mean, at least some of the models do. Right?
Can I read this? First of all, Stephen Schneider, who's one of the grand old men of the IPCC, I was just reading an article the other day that where actually somebody who's at the Woodrow Wilson School is just describing the climate change effort as led by a group of elderly scientists. But anyway, Schneider's been doing this since the 70s. He's actually trained as a biologist, and he's at Stanford. In the 70s, he was seriously writing lots of articles about global cooling. And let me read this. These are headlines from the New York Times. September 18th, 1924, Macmillan reports signs of new ice age. March 27th, 1933, America in longest warm spell since 1776. May 21, 1974, scientists ponder why world's climate is changing, a major cooling widely considered to be inevitable. December 27, 2005, past hot times hold few reasons to relax about new warming. So there we go.
I guess, you know, again, I don't believe we're qualified to talk about these about the state of climate science right now. But my understanding is that it has been several decades since any significant number of climate scientists have proposed or taken seriously the idea that we're about to enter an age of cooling. My sense is that there's nothing that you will read in the climate literature today that will indicate that there's that belief exists among scientists. Now, Jason may disagree with that.
I just want to say one thing. I mean, I can't judge this, but I can tell you there are three papers that have been published in the last 3 years in the sort of Rolls-Royce of these journals, Geophysical Research Letters, where people are using the models, and there is a belief among some climate scientists who are getting published in the top journal that there are intrinsic cycles in the Earth's climate, which there have to be because it's a highly nonlinear system.
Of course.
And there's a lot of evidence that there was an abrupt switch in 1976 with a 0.2 degree centigrade increase in tropical Pacific surface ocean temperatures, and that was there's a belief among at least a small group of climate scientists, by no means a majority, but this little group, who are getting published in peer-edited journals, that there are these 20 to 30 year cycles, and there's evidence that we flipped into a warm cycle in 76, and it's possible, according to these guys who are a distinct minority, no question about it, that, you know, we may switch, it's possible that we could switch into a cool cycle.
Right, but we're talking about, even in that case, we're talking about microcycles in the type of time frame we're talking about. We're not talking about an ice age. We're talking about a 20 to 30 to 40-year cycle. We're not, you know, and what I understood you to be asking about is whether we're headed for some sort of something on a scale of an ice age or a little ice age or something like that, and I think of that as something that would happen on a scale of centuries
right.
or something along those lines.
And I understood your answer to be that we don't know, no scientists are writing about this. And so it's not that we have reason to believe it's not going to happen. We just don't have any knowledge.
Well, also, there's a climate
scientist. We don't understand the cycles.
Again, I'm not a climate scientist. It doesn't make sense for this panel to be answering a question like that.
I can say this. There's a whole book written by a climate scientist at Virginia named Ruddiman, who's an eminent guy in the field, and his hypothesis, which is more, I don't know how widely accepted it is, but he thinks that we have been in a long-term cooling phase, moving toward a new ice age, and he thinks actually that human emissions we've been changing the Earth a pretty long time, and he thinks emissions of methane, which is a more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, have for a long time, thousands of years, actually blunted the cooling that would have otherwise gone on. This is a pretty widely cited book. It's an interesting book. And he, by the way, this guy is in no sense considered a skeptic about CO2. He thinks CO2 is obviously he would, since he thinks methane has had a big impact and he thinks, you know, it's even if there is a cooling cycle, it's CO2 could still be in too much, and CO2 could still be very dangerous.
One thing I'll just add to this is I think this. There is a certain level of uncertainty that's inherent, and there are certain things we don't know in environmental policy. I mean, there are all sorts of, you know, things that were generally consensus views. There was a time when we thought having lots of smoke in the air from burning of wood and the like in cities would prevent us all from getting TB. And this was what people really believed, you know, about 100 years ago. Now that would strike us not just as, you know, scientifically indefensible, but just kind of insane, right? I mean, it's a whole different. So we are confined by our current set of understandings, and there are going to be things beyond that 100 years from now people will look back and say, oh, my God, I can't believe they believed that. But we have no way of identifying what those things are today. The other thing I would say is that there is a sense in any of these sorts of discussions where one thing we can talk about is there are certain sets of institutional arrangements which is a general matter increase overall societal resiliency and blunt the effects of climatic or other environmental changes or unexpected changes, whether it's, you know, climate change due to industrial emissions, whether it's some natural ice age, whether it's something caused by a meteor or asteroid collision. We do know that certain types of institutions that enhance technological innovation, that allow for the reallocation of resources through market processes, that allow for wealth accumulation, do reduce a lot of the negative impacts of the sorts of things that we're worried about. So, for example, if disease is our big concern, worrying about the Earth's temperature it should be the last thing we focus on. We know how to control disease vectors. We know how to do it very, very well and very, very cheaply, and it has nothing to do with climate. If we're concerned about uncertainty, generally there are, and we want to take that seriously, there are ways to deal with that that may not line up with the ways we tend to talk about climate policy. But
I think an interesting, can I ask, just throw this out to the group, I think an interesting political economy question is this. We spent all this money in the Clean Air Act, but people realize very discernible benefits from the Clean Air Act. Without even looking at the epidemiology and looking at the impact of cleaner air and reducing, you know, certain kinds of illnesses and premature deaths, I think a lot of people in America thought, gosh, you know, look at Los Angeles. Los Angeles is, everybody would say, way better than it was in the early 1970s. What happens if we spend all this money on climate change, on decarbonizing the economy, which is a whole other magnitude of cost, and temperature kind of continues to increase slowly? What's going to happen in Congress? What are people going to say? That was good we did that. It was good we spent all that money. I think there are things you can do. These are kind of the win-win things Sean was talking about. Certain kinds of conservation, which are really make a lot of sense in cost-benefit terms. If you've adopted those things in your legislation, then people are going to say, well, maybe we're wrong about climate change, but I'm sure glad we did X, Y, and Z, you know, and we made our houses more efficient or our businesses more efficient. But then there are other things where people are going to say, you mean to tell me that we drove the unemployment rate up by another 2% or we made poor people pay, you know, an extra $780 a year for heating and air conditioning and nothing happened? It didn't have any impact? I think that the uncertainty does impact maybe your if you want a sustainable legislation that isn't going to get amended into nothing 2-3 years after it's passed, I think you kind of want to go for the things that make sense anyway.
Although the cost may not be so visible. I mean, just from a political economy perspective, you know, 5, 6, 10 years down the road, there's an extra $700 effective tax, but it's not going to be that visible probably. So the question is, will it get politically mobilized?
I don't know. I think it's your heating bill or your electric bill. People see that.
I also think the regional disparities Jason mentioned become important. I mean, they're actually in the Clean Air Act amendments of 1977. There's the famous studies by Peter Pashigian looking at the vote patterns, and it was very clear that in Congress they were very well aware of the regional disparities created by, for example, the PSD provisions, the parts of the country that were already – that are basically – I'm going to oversimplify – the parts of the country that already had dirty air. The members of Congress from those parts of the country aggressively supported measures to impose regulatory controls on the parts of the country that didn't yet have dirty air as a way of essentially preventing the loss of industry and the loss of economic activity to those states. And Peter Pashigian did some studies looking at vote patterns and finding that this explains votes better than anything else you want to look at. And there's also the Hassler-Ackerman work looking at kind of telling a narrative that's very similar. And I think those – if you have policies that have grossly disparate regional impacts, that definitely affects the sustainability of certain types of regulatory regimes.
I don't disagree with that, but I guess I want to respond to the premise that this is going to have the kind of costs that we're talking about across the sectors that Jason was mentioning. In an environment where we are now subject to the volatility of oil prices, for example, changing technologies in a way that makes us less susceptible to that volatility on international markets is something that might result in the long run, maybe even in the short and medium run in consumers who feel more comfortable with the environment in which they're purchasing things. So, for example, people who have cars that have higher mileage are feeling more comfortable in an environment where we don't know how much oil is going to cost. Now, obviously, right now, with gas at $1.80 a gallon, people suddenly have changed their minds again, whereas 6 months ago, with gas at $3.75 or $4 a gallon, people felt differently. But I personally would be surprised if the trend over time was not upward, and also if that volatility wasn't something that created a lot of problems in consumer confidence and consumers' ability to feel like they're able to function. So, people I know who have
who've insulated themselves from that feel rather comfortable with it. So if we can change technology in a way that is less reliant on that, it seems to me it's not necessarily going to have the kind of negative impacts we're talking about. Now, that being said, there will be places where there are price shocks that result from what Jason's calling decarbonization. I don't doubt that, but I think the key is to create technologies and create the conditions for technology that will minimize that. And I think in other contexts, we've managed to do that. I mean, obviously, it's a smaller scale, but when the Clean Air Act was first passed, there were a lot of people who thought it would be the end of the American economy to implement the Clean Air Act, and it was not. And so, you know, we are talking about a different scale now, but I have a lot of confidence in our ability to innovate in a way that actually is going to be to people's benefit, you know, both distributionally and in terms of efficiency of allocating resources over time.
It does seem like a lot of this debate tracks how much technological optimism people have. I mean, if you have, in some ways, it crosses political lines, but if you have a lot of optimism about technological innovation, you're likely to think the response to a lot of those increased costs is going to be technological change. It's going to mitigate them. But that's another area of radical uncertainty. We don't know, right?
Of course. The questions are just, I guess, Bob.
Rob Nadels of University of Montana. In Montana, around this time of year, there's a very large informal organization. Consists of about 95% of the people in the state. That is to say, everybody except academics and Hollywood folks who don't have to live in Montana in the winter. The name of the organization is Montanans for Global Cooling, or Montanans for Global Warming. Points up Jason's point about the benefits and disadvantages being very unevenly distributed. Old-time Montanans talk about how harsh the winters used to be, as old-timers always do, and how easy we have it now. And I've been there for about 20 years, and I do notice a little improvement of the climate, and that would be associated with warming. You know, as a historian, what I think about when I hear these conversations and I read about this is the brain trust of the New Deal. I mean, you have a crisis, and everybody gets together, and we're gonna think our way out of this. We're gonna plan our way out of this crisis, and they come up with a lot of different solutions, and ultimately they really don't work. But in the long run, those people who are involved in the project all benefit because they get the grants and they enjoy a permanent increase in power, and all the rest of us enjoy a permanent loss in freedom. And that's really what bothers me about this conversation. If we think we're going to be able to, well, if they thought they could micromanage the American economy to bring it back to prosperity, that's nothing compared to the complexity that's going to be faced in trying to micromanage or at least significantly change a global climate system. I think it's probably the biggest display of hubris since the days of the Tower of Babel. So I guess, you know, Jonathan, there was a story, I don't know if it's true, but when I was a kid, there was a story that you could take a penny and you could put it on a railroad track and it was correctly placed, you could derail a train. Just a penny. I realize all of you may not want to derail the train, but for those who maybe want to, is there any hope of doing that?
Well, I mean, one thing I would just say is an initial matter. I mean, there is a certain inertia in the regulatory process that's set in motion. I mean, basically, once you say greenhouse gases are an air pollutant under the Clean Air Act, there are all sorts of levers that can be pulled by the agency or by courts that are asked to force the agency to pull those levers, and it kind of has a momentum all its own. And so I think if the goal were to be derailing, it requires something quite dramatic legislatively. The other thing I would say is that I do think if the goal is really reducing the costs or the risks of climate change, there are a set of policies we could talk about that don't involve the massive planning enterprise of a cap and trade, and that don't necessarily involve some of the things involved. I mean, we really want lots of innovation. We know how to do that. It doesn't involve subsidies administered by the Department of Energy. It involves getting rid of barriers to innovation and creating super competitive rewards something like patents on steroids, prizes like the British Empire or something. We know that that generates innovation. It doesn't generate a lot of rents for interest groups, but it generates innovation. And we know that, that if we replaced a lot of taxes on things like income with an energy tax or a carbon tax, which is essentially a sort of consumption tax that lots of conservatives have been calling for a long, long time, we don't have to deal with – we have to deal – there's some difficult things we have to do, but we don't have to deal with the massive – bureaucratic planning enterprise that even cap and trade requires to figure out what can be traded for what and how you allocate the caps. Politically, the same reason that those sorts of approaches don't involve some of those sorts of enterprises, they're politically more difficult because you don't have as many constituencies that see the benefit of that. I mean, you don't have companies like Enron, which was the biggest proponent of cap and trade 10 years ago because it thought it was going to dominate the market. And so you don't, the political economy is much different.
I mean, the train may just chug slowly, because, getting back to Jason's point, I think a lot of industry would like some kind of regulatory apparatus, in part because of these preemption questions, in part to give them some stability. But that doesn't mean they necessarily want very costly regulations. Some of them are gaming it. And you may end up, once the costs mount, in getting something that isn't extremely effective, and it's just kind of chugging along. Now, that would just be kind of deadweight loss on the economy, and it wouldn't necessarily do much, but that is one possible scenario.
Well, also congressional intervention. I think the entire structure of many environmental laws, they're very, very vague, many of them, with these incredibly optimistic goals, was deliberate by Congress. What do? You say, look what we did. We did all this great stuff. We're going to give you a really clean environment. And then you preserve the discretion to intervene on a case-by-case basis as a member of Congress to prevent costs from being imposed that are too high on particular important constituents. That's what I think explains basically the structure of many environmental laws, and it was deliberate by members of Congress. So is there any reason to think that they're just going to – look, if constituents are faced with bearing really big costs – and by the way, everybody talks about what the states are doing. No state has done anything yet that has made anybody really bear costs. California, I don't think the regulations are finalized under the general climate change bill. And, it's been a great opportunity kind of for political entrepreneurship. But things change if you get to the stage of saying, we're going to really start to impose costs on people now. And that's when, those costs are like lots and lots of little pennies. I don't know about one penny, but you put enough on there, the train can't roll.
Just one question about one aspect you haven't, the panel hasn't touched on much, which makes this a very different kind of regulatory scheme than we've seen ever, I think, in U.S. history, which is the vertical integration with the international regulatory scheme, which, and I don't know if we have a model of assessing how that will affect the way that our federal and state regulators are responding to this, because if they're, for instance, responding to international targets or internationally mandated targets, that would leave them with perhaps maybe less flexibility. I don't know if – I was just curious hearing from those of you about what you think the impact of the international component of this, which is really different from the Clean Air Act or any other form of major regulatory scheme I think we've had, at least as I know, in the environmental area.
Yeah, I think that – Even if the United States agreed to specific targets as part of some treaty, I don't think that that would necessarily translate into dictating action. I mean, if you look at Europe, that doesn't – true, it's certainly less true elsewhere. I do think that there's going to be a lot of soft – I think it's going to be part of the kind of political discourse. And I think also if we do move in a cap-and-trade model, there will be ways it's concretely affected if, in fact – trading, especially with multinationals, crosses national lines. So there's, and right now we have a very fragmentary system. I mean, there are all these various trading mechanisms. There's ones in Europe. There's kind of ones under Kyoto. There's some in the United States, voluntary ones, and they're all completely distinct. And I think there will be some move if cap and trade really does take off for some kinds of limited integration, and that is different. There's very limited role models for environmental regulation or treaties across boundaries that are actually substantive. I mean, the Montreal Protocol and the ozone is really it, and so international environmental lawyers talk about it endlessly, but it's a fairly small, relatively phenomenon compared to what we're talking about. So there is almost nothing.
And I would just add to that, I mean, there are two issues that I think increase the complexity of it. One is that if you do anything which operates as a tax, whether it's a direct tax or it's cap and trade or something, there is, if it's significant, there's political pressure to compensate for the effects of that in terms of international competitiveness. And there's massive questions about how you deal with that under, for example, the WTO regime. I mean, how do you, if you were to tax imports based on the carbon equivalent of their energy sources, would that be something that would be WTO compliant or not? And the other issue is the one, Julian, that you've kind of written about, which is all these delegation issues, in the sense that if we internationally try and adopt a model which is the analog to what we do domestically, which is we endorse these broad goals and then we give the authority to some entity to fill in the details over time, either itself or to fill in details that then require domestic entities to fill in more details, how do we do with that? We've almost been confronted with that in the Montreal Protocol context, but I don't think we really know what we'd do with that. I mean, would Congress have to, as a legal matter, if international entity changes the way we're supposed to deal with one greenhouse gas versus another, would Congress then have to re-endorse that or modify legislation before a regulatory agency that's implementing this domestically could act on that? I mean, there are lots of theories about how that would work, and then there's also the question of, as a practical matter, what would our courts and our agencies actually do when confronted with that? I don't think we know. I happen to like your approaches better than some of the alternatives, but I don't know if we have any sense of what would actually happen.
The one thing that has happened internationally of significance is that there's a mechanism that's been set up that gives developing countries an incentive to reduce their carbon dioxide emissions, at least in theory, by engaging in projects that avoid carbon emissions, because there's a market for them to use those avoided carbon emissions and essentially market them to folks in the European Union who need to reduce their carbon emissions. And so that trading system has been developed as an international scheme. It's not very robust yet, and it also has been criticized by some people, most notably Michael Wara at Stanford, for not actually accomplishing its goals, because it's too difficult to figure out if the carbon emissions that are avoided are actually being avoided, if they're actually additional reductions beyond what would have been done anyway if we didn't have that system in place. But that kind of model, where we give a set of incentives to developing countries to behave in one way and a set of different incentives to developed countries that complement the incentives we give to developing countries, seems in theory rather promising if what we want is to create overall global reductions in greenhouse gas emissions.
Yeah, just a quick point. My understanding is that the majority of the offsets that have been sold by developing countries under Kyoto have been for flaring, that is to say burning CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons. Now, they're not even really supposed, those are supposed to be being phased out under Montreal Protocol, but developing countries got to still produce some of them. So you've got them basically taking a horrible greenhouse gas, way, way worse than carbon dioxide, and burning it to generate, among other things, carbon dioxide, and they get credit for that. Because, that's the majority of the credits under Kyoto.
Yeah, those are the early credits. I think right now that's finished, essentially. I think that's, I'm not going to dispute that characterization of it. Right now, I think the majority of the credits are countries developing natural gas plants, for example, instead of coal plants, and saying there would have been a coal plant here. Instead, there's going to be a natural gas plant or some other technology plant, and we deserve credit for the difference between that. And again, the question there really seems to be, would they really have built a coal plant instead, or are they building all the coal plants they can anyway, and they're also building natural gas plants? And that seems to be, that's obviously a critical question.
I think this is going to have to be our last question. So,
I'm Nadia Netzel. I'm at Southern University in Baton Rouge, and I'm going to see how quickly I can make this. There are essentially two points I want to make, and I was hoping the panel could comment on them. The first one, I think, is that Professor Johnson mentioned that media has a strong predisposition towards emphasizing their belief in climate change. And my research has corroborated that, and I think you almost understated it, and I can make an analogy. About 3 years ago on August 28th, I lost my home due to 11 feet of water. that escaped from the 17th Street Canal. And I saw, to my very great surprise, that I lived in a wealthy neighborhood. You could have asked any of my neighbors in Lakeview, in the New Orleans neighborhood of Lakeview, whether they lived in a wealthy neighborhood, and none of them would have said it was wealthy, nor would most of the United States say that was a wealthy neighborhood. We also saw allegations that this was designed to attack the African-American community. Well, our city was 70% minority-majority. That's who we are. And so I was highly affronted by the media's portrayal of what was a disastrous event as in a way that they could maximize what they thought were the most politically expedient points they wanted to make. And that leads me to some of the things I've seen at this conference and at the one across the street. I was listening to a discussion of post-Hernando de Soto's arguments on why capitalism fails, and I didn't recognize this as being the same scholar. I'm familiar with his argument that essentially it's a lot of overregulation that's led to a lot of trouble. And you could see that, to my mind, I could see that in the mortgage industry, in which the encouraging of banks to make risky loans has snowballed and created a problem. Simply, and the analogy in my situation is the encouragement of the government to provide flood insurance to people who are living in floodplains has encouraged people to live in floodplains and created a larger disaster. So I, too, am looking for a way to derail what looks to me like if we proceed along these lines of protecting against this purported climate change could be another very costly project that's going to have Uncle Sam deeper and deeper in my pockets, backed up by the Kyoto Protocol and other types of systems.
I don't know. One chapter in the book talks about sort of the media and all this. What I've done is I've collected all the articles, and I wanted to take a really super credible publication, so I took The Economist, and I collected all the articles about global warming in The Economist, and here's what happens. For example, there's an article, some scientists thought they detected a slowing in the North Atlantic Current, which is a possible consequence on some of the general circulation models of global warming. So The Economist, boom, puts a story in. Scientists find current is slowing. About 4 or 5 months later, there was some other scientific work done, and it showed that that was not actually true, that they had a bigger, they had basically a longer time frame, a bigger database, and they showed, yeah, there are these fluctuations. Now we understand there are fluctuations up and down over time. It's not really slowing. It's just a small cycle. Did The Economist print an article saying, guess what, we said that scientists have picked up an early sign of global warming? But it turns out that wasn't really true. They didn't print that article. And that's what that happens over and over and over again. You'll have a paper come out saying, here it is, the sky is falling. This is how science works. And some other scientists say, I don't know, is that really true? Is the sky really falling? And you find, well, maybe not. Or maybe it's falling, but really slowly. But does the media print those later articles? No. Those are never, people never hear about those. They never know those happened. All they hear is the sky is falling.
Well, I think we are out of time, so if everyone could please join me in thanking our panel. And I don't know if Gene had any concluding conference remarks.
I just wanted to thank all our speakers and participants, and I also wanted to thank our staff, Lee Otis, I think most of you have met, Aaron Sheely and Andrew Olson put the logistical work to put all this together, so I wanted to thank them.
Thank you.